You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, Ben Mathis here with a favor to ask. If you haven't already, subscribe to Kick-Ass News and rate and review us on iTunes. And if you have a moment, share Kick-Ass News with a couple of your friends and recommend us on Facebook or Twitter. As we approach our 200th episode, I really hope you'll spread the word about Kick-Ass News and help keep us at the top of the iTunes charts. Thanks again for listening, and now enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. Human cadavers, fecal transplants, pig inseminations, and medical maggots are the kind of things that make most people's stomachs turn. But they're exactly the kind of taboo and often disgusting subjects that get science writer Mary Roach excited. With her sharp wit and her fearless curiosity for the odd, awful, and often overlooked aspects of the human body and the world around us, Mary's been called America's funniest science writer by the Washington Post. Her humorous and enlightening articles have appeared in Outside, Wired, National Geographic, and the New York Times Magazine, among others. Her books have continually topped the New York Times bestseller list, starting with Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, followed by Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void, Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal, My Planet, Finding Humor in the Oddest Places, and her latest book, Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Today, Mary Roach comes on the podcast to talk about the oft-ignored aspects of modern warfare that relate not to the killing, but to keeping soldiers alive. She'll talk about various oddball military research projects with names like the Chicken Gun and Stench Soup. She talks about why hearing loss is becoming an epidemic among America's veterans, why diarrhea is enemy number one for U.S. Special Forces, and how she experienced firsthand the insomnia of working on a nuclear submarine. Plus, why combat fashion matters, how medics train for real combat scenarios, and why maggots might be a wounded soldier's best friend. Coming up with science writer Mary Roach in just a moment. Mary Roach is a best-selling science writer who's covered such taboo subjects as human cadavers in her first book, Stiff, The Afterlife in her book, Spook, The Science of Sex in her book, Bonk, and Human Digestion in her last book, Gulp. Her latest is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Mary, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
You have carved a very distinctive niche for yourself as a humor writer who covers the overlooked scientific angles of everyday life, often involving the human body, and you do so in a humorous, often cheeky way. Do you consider yourself a humor writer or a science writer?
Kind of neither one. I'm flattered by both of those titles, but I don't feel like I really live up to either one. I'm not consistently hilarious enough to be a humor writer, and I'm not, I don't feel like I'm a science writer in the sense of a real having a beat in an area of expertise and really being reporting and understanding cutting edge science. So I'm kind of I don't know what I am. I don't have a category that really fits. I'm kind of some weird outlier.
Well, I was interested to learn that you came from a public relations background originally, not a science background. When did you get lured into science writing?
Actually, while I was a public relations person, I worked at the San Francisco Zoological Society, and I was a public affairs. I was the person that the media would call. And so sometimes I would get calls from reporters, and I was far more interested in chatting with them and going down a rabbit hole with whatever they were looking into than, you know, doing my job. For example, somebody called once, a reporter, saying there was a rumor that the cheetah had been sucked dry by fleas, and, you know, it was this horrible scandal, which wasn't true so far as I know. And I, rather than denying the rumor, I was just fascinated by the whole idea that, like, well, how many fleas would it take? How much blood per flea? How much blood is in a cheetah? How would this be possible? Could it happen? And my boss was just horrified that I was encouraging this reporter and kind of extending the lifespan of this malicious rumor. Anyway, so clearly I wasn't cut out for public relations. And I think I was just, science writing or whatever it is that I do was just a way to follow my curiosity. And so, you know, it began even back then, which was, you know, this was shortly after I graduated from college. So I guess that's kind of where it all began.
Yeah. And I think you say that you had a psychology degree when you graduated, but without a broader science background. Do you ever encounter snobbishness when you're dealing with scientists or other science communicators?
No, I don't. They're incredibly patient scientists. As a rule, they're really quite understanding. I'm very upfront with the fact that I really don't know. If I don't know what they're talking about, I stop them pretty quickly and have them kind of rewind and talk to me as though they're talking to a small child, maybe an eighth grader, and I have no shame about that. And I you know, if there is snobbishness, it's behind my back. They're really very kind and patient people, scientists.
Well, you've carved out, as I said, a pretty interesting niche for yourself. You tackle everything from human cadavers and fecal transplants in your previous books to leeches and maggots in this latest book. You seem to have an 11-year-old boy's affinity for the disgusting. Have you ever encountered anything that you just couldn't stomach?
No.
No.
I don't think I have. The only time I ever had to leave a room literally gagging was not for any book research. It had nothing to do with a book. It was an autopsy. I'm friends with Judy Melnick, who's the medical examiner here in Alameda County, and she sort of made it a personal goal of hers to make Mary Roach sick. And so she invited me one day. She's like, oh, come on down. We have a couple interesting cases. And they were, okay, you can kind of look up, you know, like the timeline of what happens to bodies if they've been sitting at room temperature for 2 weeks. And it's not pretty. And these were large bodies. And left the room. Couldn't take it. Could not take it.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not impossible to make you queasy.
No, it can be done.
Okay.
And she did it.
Well, you say that your latest book, Grunt, isn't about killing and weapons of war, but it's about the science of keeping troops alive. How did you come up with the idea for this book?
I was reporting a story in India on the world's hottest chili pepper, and there was this insane chili pepper eating contest there that's quite brutal, and people taken away in ambulances. Anyway, I was covering this story, and while I was there, somebody told me that the Indian Defense Ministry had a lab that had weaponized this chili pepper, made sort of exploding chili pepper bomb for in a crowd dispersal, similar to a pepper spray. So I went to that laboratory, and you know, at this lab they were developing a leech repellent, And just that's so, I don't know, a leech repellent. It just spoke to me. That was just this moment where I realized that military science is yet another bizarre, interesting world of science to step into. And I knew nothing about it. And so that always appeals to me when there's this whole world that you have an opportunity to explore. So I just started poking around and that's how it happened.
Well, who volunteers for clinical trials on leech repellents?
I think the staff at the lab is conscripted to go down to the river and roll up their trousers and try out different compounds. Hideous.
Well, this book reveals such an interesting side to war. You know, if you watch Restrepo or Saving Private Ryan, you don't hear about dehydration, hypothermia, hearing loss. It's about the more immediate dodging a bullet type of emergencies. What's great about this book is that it really underscores the type of gauntlet of dangers our troops have to survive. I mean, even once you get past the whole thing of not getting shot or not getting blown up, there's still this whole laundry list of threats, from not getting food poisoning to snakes to pest-borne diseases. What was it that interested you in that aspect of war versus just the fighting and the killing?
I like to go to the places most people don't go. I kind of, the things that fall between the cracks, there's a lot of, you know, when somebody writes books about war and combat, typically it's about the high drama stuff, and that makes sense because they are life and death stories, but they overlook a lot of really interesting, for me anyway, stories. Like you said, this is a book about flies and maggots and extreme heat and sleep deprivation and extreme stress and incredibly loud noises and hearing loss and all of that in the context of combat, which is a whole foreign land to me. So it was, you know, those elements kind of seemed to make an interesting, appealing package for me.
Yeah, and you were just talking about how a lot of these are things that everyone at some point has to deal with. What were some of the things that you learned about that maybe have or could have a non-combat application in the private sector?
Well, most of it, with the exception of, there's a fair amount of the book that dealt with things like, how do you design a vehicle for driving over large bombs? Like, what kind of vehicle do you design if there's going to be like a 100-pound bomb that goes off underneath it? And how do you test it? You need a crash test dummy for that specific dummy. So, or wounds, if you step on an IED, some of the specific wounds that and damage that happens from that. So some of it was particular to combat, and hopefully not things that every person will encounter. But you know, just I got fascinated by flies, and flies, they digest their food outside their body. They kind of vomit up these enzymes and like make a little puddle out of the food and then slurp it up, which I thought, imagine if humans, what would restaurants be like if we did that? This is bizarre. They're really weird creatures. But they were also in terms of the military, they really were the enemy. You would actually see from World War II these posters that say, this is the enemy, and there's this fly, and somebody's bayoneting this giant fly. And because they were the cause, they were spreading disease, because on a battlefield, you have this highly unsanitary situation where you got like open pit latrine. It's like, you know, hundreds of men crapping into this pit, and then you got the mess tent, which isn't screened back then, and the flies with their little hairy feet going from the crap over to the mess hall and, you know, inoculating it with this bacteria. And then this food is sitting out unrefrigerated because you're out in the battlefield or near it, and the bacteria is multiplying exponentially. And now you've got, next mealtime, you've just gotten hundreds of men sick, and that the cycle continues. Those guys are sick, they get diarrhea, they go to the latrine. Hundreds more. And really, flies were the enemy. They were killing the diseases, you know, dysentery, yellow fever, whatever. They were killing far more troops than the weapons, combat bullets. And now if I go to a restaurant, I see flies flying around. I'm like, oh, that's not a good sign. Nah, not a good sign. If there's food sitting out and flies, bad news.
Yeah, and one of the interesting stories in here, you talk about how the British Army had a quota for officers in Egypt during World War II of how many flies they had to kill per day, right?
Yes, they had a fly death quota. They had to kill, each soldier would have to kill 50 flies a day. I don't know how they, did they keep the, like the tweezers go and like keep the bodies and put little notches on their fly swatter? I'm not sure exactly how the death quota worked. But yeah, there were fly control units. Like that you could be actually, your World War II service record could be like fly control unit. So they were, that kind of stuff I find fascinating.
Well, speaking of flies, you discuss how a Civil War doctor used maggots as the perfect treatment for military wounds. Now the FDA has actually approved maggots for cleaning and treating injuries. Is it hard to get an injured soldier to let a doctor put a maggot in their wound?
It's not done. Most these days, it's called maggot debridement therapy. And what they're what maggots is, we all know, they prefer dead flesh. That's why you see maggots on dead bodies. But in a wound, they do what's called debridement, which is get rid of the dead flesh, and they leave the live flesh, and it fights infection several different ways. So these soldiers would come in, and this was in World War I, and with these hideous wounds that were infested, and this doctor noticed when he removed the maggots that the wounds were not infected, and that there was like healthy pink tissue growing in, and the maggots seemed to be helping, not hurting. So there is this military entomologist that I spent time with who was advocating using maggots for some of these IED injuries that tends to be infection and reinfection, because these bits of earth and sand get blasted deep into the wound. It's very hard to get them all out and to fight infection. And that's an uphill battle, because maggots are maggots. They're disgusting. You have to change them out. A nursing staff has to be trained, and you got to like take them out before they get too big and they want to go and pupate and become flies, and then you'd have flies in the hospital, and that's not good, as we know. So they're usually mostly wound clinics for like diabetic foot ulcers, wounds that tend to be very, very, very hard to get them to heal. And in some cases, people end up with amputations to the foot. So the maggots are used. And yes, you're right, they are an FDA-approved medical device. And with a Medicare reimbursement code as well. George Peck, the entomologist that I spent time with at Walter Reed, had a lot of resistance from the powers that be in his efforts to have maggots as part of the arsenal in fighting infection in some of these wounds, because they seem old timey and gross. That is part of it.
Well, on the lighter side of things, in the introduction to the book, you set the tone by talking about something called a chicken gun. It sounds like something Johnny Knoxville would do on Jackass, but apparently this has real life and death ramifications for pilots, huh?
It does. Yeah, the chicken gun is pretty much what it sounds like. It's a heavy artillery piece that fires thawed out supermarket chickens. And it does this. It does sound like a Jackass episode. I wouldn't be surprised if they actually hit each other with the chicken gun, but I don't watch the show regularly enough to know. But what they use it for is testing pieces of jets, like the canopy, the windscreen, that to make sure it could withstand bird strike, a collision with a Canada goose or a mallard duck, whatever happens to be in your flight path. And they use chickens just because they're cheaper and it's easy to have a kind of consistent, this is the standard that we use to test. We all agree we're going to use this chicken. And, even though like chickens don't fly, they don't have the same silhouette in flight. I mean, they're not identical. It's the thinking is, it's kind of a worst case scenario. If your jet can withstand a supermarket chicken being hurled at it, then it'll probably be okay with, a duck.
Now, do these chickens have beaks? Because I think you say that the beak of a bird at that speed is kind of like armor piercing bullets.
Well, yes, there's a phenomenon in bird strike called the feathered bullet phenomenon whereby a bird that you wouldn't normally worry about, say a starling or something much smaller, if it hits straight on, it could pierce whatever the material is that the canopy is made out of. It's it just right through and then hit the pilot. I imagine that's a pretty rare occurrence, but yeah. So the chickens are headless. Chickens, so yeah. The feather bullet phenomenon, that's a whole, you gotta just hope, you gotta just like try to avoid the smaller birds, I guess, yeah. Or hope for the best, because you're absolutely right. That'd be more like the chicken is more like the feathered cannonball phenomenon.
Yeah, and a lot of these things like the chicken gun sound like the kind of thing that a Senate Oversight Committee would probably rail about as a waste of taxpayer money. And another good example of this sort of thing is in World War II, the OSS had something called the Who Me bomb, to a more recent incarnation of stink bombs called stench soup. Talk a little bit about the history of military stink bombs.
The OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA, In World War II, they got this idea from the Brits, and it was that the idea was that you would have this incredibly potent smell, kind of like somebody's shit their pants, basically. And you would put this in a little, either an atomizer. The Brits had a little atomizer, like you'd spray perfume from, a little pocket atomizer. The U.S. version was cheaper. It was these little tubes, little sort of lead tubes like paint would come in with a nozzle at the end, and you would squeeze it. And the idea here is that it was something cheap and small that you would distribute to resistance groups, people who were motivated to help out in the war, civilians, that is, who just were looking for small ways to help. So you'd go sidle up next to a German officer, say, and spray this on his uniform. And there were a lot of problems with this. It was Who Me, as in, you know, who farted, was the nickname. SAC 23 was the technical name of it. Anyway, so the idea was, that you squeeze this tube. They had a lot of problems with backfire. And that was actually the term that was used. Backfire, as in you'd squeeze it and some of it would come out the wrong end and contaminate the person trying to deploy the weapon. And there was also a fair amount of dribble. They put a little collar on the tube. They tested a bunch of different collars for the tube. I mean, the amount, this is a big fat file in the National Archives on the OSS Who Me project. Just probably 100 letters back and forth between the OSS, the chemical company, Arthur D. Little, whom they contracted, and the testing lab in Maryland. All of these individuals, dozens of individuals involved in this effort to make this little stench spray. It was very, and just the increasing annoyance on the part of the person heading up the project when, like, you know, they were shipped and half of them were leaking in the box and the rest of them. And this poor guy set up a mannequin, you know, like a dressmaker's dummy, and put a uniform on it, tried it in his office, got it all over his hand, wrote this angry letter, like, we can do better than this. And then in the end, they finally had these things ready to go, and about 2 weeks later, the atomic bomb was dropped. So a different kind of bomb, a lot more effective, was deployed instead of the stink bombs. They weren't really bombs, but yeah.
Well, you tested out a more recent incarnation of this called the stench soup. What does that smell like, and what's it used for?
Yeah, stench soup is something that was made at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia at the behest of the U.S. military. It's a non-lethal weapon, here again. The idea being, here's something, they wanted something, the military, that is, universally disgusting. And that's actually not that easy. There are odors that in other cultures people will judge to be edible, wearable, depending on what you've grown up with and what you're familiar with, you might not find certain smells that objectionable. Sewage, vomit, vomit is a smell that in a different context, that can smell like Parmesan cheese. If you're blindfolded and you smell Parmesan cheese, you may find that really disgusting because it really does smell like vomit. And so the context is important, your cultural your upbringing, your exposures. So a lot of work went into like, what is the universally detested smell? And it turns out to be something, it's actually a commercially available smell called U.S. government standard bathroom malodor. And it's a hideous bathroom smell that was designed to protesting latrine deodorizers. They needed something standardized, like a chicken from the chicken gun. They needed a standardized horrible smell that they could then test deodorants against. So they started with that. And then what was interesting, they added a kind of fruity, pleasant top note. The reason being, when you are exposed to a new smell for the first time, you take a tentative sniff, like just to try it out.
Right.
And in this case, you'd think, oh, that's kind of nice. And then you'd be encouraged on the keeper inhale, a technical term there, to really suck in a lot of it. And that's when you'd get hit by the U.S. government standard bathroom malodor horrible. And that kind of the mix of fruity plus bathroom smell made it even worse. And also, it made it unfamiliar, and that's important with deterring people from getting people to leave a space or dispersing a crowd. Because if you smell something that you can't identify, you don't know that it's safe, and your instinct is to get away from it because it may be dangerous. So the combination of the fruity plus the horrible toilet smell created not only awful and off-putting, but kind of scary. So that is stench soup.
So they use this to disperse mobs and clear buildings, is that right?
That's the idea. Wow. I asked Pam Dalton, who is the head of that lab that created it, I said, what did the military do with this? Where was it deployed? And she said, you know, we gave them the formula. I don't know what they've done with it. I don't know where it's used. I don't have that information as to whatever became of stench soup and whether it's regularly used.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with science writer Mary Roach when we come back in just a moment. Sometimes all it takes is one little fact or one little piece of wisdom to change your life forever. That's the purpose of a great podcast called Something You Should Know. In each episode, the host Mike Carruthers interviews top experts in their field to bring you fascinating information and advice to help you save time and money, advance your career, become wealthy, improve your relationships, and help you simply get more out of life. In addition, Mike uncovers and shares short, engaging pieces of intel that you can use to make your life better today, right now. So subscribe to Something You Should Know wherever you listen to podcasts or at somethingyoushouldknow.net. And now, back to the show. Well, your first chapter in Grunt talks about the science of combat fashion and the kinds of considerations designers have to deal with in making clothes to keep a soldier from getting killed. You actually talk at length about just the problem of how to fasten one's uniform. Why are buttons preferred over more 2.0 technology like Velcro or zippers?
Well, it kind of depends on what your job is in the military. For example, if you're a sniper and you're going to be spending hours lying on your front waiting for something to happen, you do not want to be lying. Actually, buttons would be bad. Buttons and zippers, a jacket or a shirt with buttons or zippers would be uncomfortable. So the day I was at the fashion studio at Natick Labs in Massachusetts, there was a sniper top, if you will, and it had a side opening. So the front was completely flat for that reason. You could use Velcro, Velcro is flatter, but it's noisy. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't want, if your job necessitates stealth, you wouldn't want Velcro. So all of these considerations, and she also, the designer, had removed the chest pockets from this top and put them on the outside of the upper arms so that the contents of the pockets would be accessible when you're lying on your belly. So that all of this thought going into these, you know, it's a seemingly simple thing. It's a shirt or a jacket. But depending on how you spend your days, some very interesting design considerations.
And one would think that function would take priority over form when it comes to designing military uniforms. But the people that you talk to talk about the importance of fashion and having a cool looking uniform, huh? That's actually important to soldiers.
Well, yes. I mean, it's not the first priority in design. It's definitely form following function. But the other side of this is that if you design something that really looks bad and makes the person wearing it feel bad about themselves, now you have you're affecting morale. Morale is important in troops. They've got enough to deal with. You know, they got enough reasons to be in a bad mood. The fact that like their pants make their butt look big or whatever it is, it counts. The other thing going on here is that if protective gear, like a chem bio, an outerwear garment that sheds chemical weapons, you don't want a garment that somebody's going to be inclined not to wear because they don't like how it fits or how it makes them look or if it's too hot. So comfort and style matter in that you don't want to do anything to discourage a person from putting that garment on if it may save their life.
And that reminds me of another issue that troops face, which is hearing loss, which apparently is the VA's number one injury. There's kind of this push and pull between a soldier's need for situational awareness and their need to protect their ears. How does the military straddle that problem between not wanting to leave a soldier without a permanent disability and trying to get them through combat alive?
Yeah, it's a serious problem. As you can imagine, war is very loud, not just bullets, bombs, sudden, very loud, high decibel noises, but lower decibel noises that go on and on for hours, like the sound of a helicopter or an armored personnel carrier traveling over concrete. That's a high enough decibel level that if you're in there for 5, 6, 12 hours, you're going to start to sustain hearing loss. So you got to protect the ears, but as you said, situational awareness, being able to hear what the other people in your unit are saying to you is important, or the sound of a car approaching on the gravel, that's important, or the sound of Velcro around the corner, somebody undoing a Velcro vest. All of these things contribute to your sense of, am I in danger? What's going on around me? So obviously, you want to save your life more than you want to save your hearing. So even though you're given as a soldier ear protection, you tend not to wear it. And it's also, you know, you're in an armored personnel carrier for a long time. It's uncomfortable, and or hot. So for those reasons, this protection doesn't get worn unless there is a kind of higher tech ear protection that, at the same time as it screens out the loud noises, it amplifies the quiet ones, like a human voice. And these are TCAPs, Tactical Communication and Protection System. These are very cool. They've got communication, wireless communications, and a mouthpiece so you can communicate with somebody in a chopper overhead, say. So that's a way around it. But not everybody has those yet. They're costly and relatively new. So, but that's where things are going because it's crazy the amount of hearing loss.
Yeah, and I think you said that technology is what SEAL Team 6 used when they killed Osama bin Laden, right?
That's what I'm told, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the biggest problems facing our troops apparently is diarrhea. You say that 77% of combatants in Iraq suffered from diarrhea, and food poisoning rates are highest among special operations forces. You know, that's the sort of thing that people may scoff at or laugh about, but it can be a life and death situation if you're talking about dehydration. How does the military try to combat those problems?
Diarrhea occurs, the rates of it are about twice as high among special operations forces, Navy SEALs and such, because they're not spending as much time on a base where the food is safe and the water is clean. They may be, when they go out on a mission, they're out in some rural village in Somalia or Yemen or the places where there's a lot of counterinsurgency work. And so they're eating with the village elders. They're drinking water that might not have been filtered or treated, goat, say, that has been left out all night, they get sick all the time. And they are traveling light. They don't have a change of pants, you know. And if you get serious gastrointestinal infection, if you're hit with really bad diarrhea from food poisoning, and your mission is to say, I don't know, take out Osama bin Laden, whatever it is, whatever your mission as a special operations guy is, you don't have the luxury of sitting it out for a few days. You just have to go forward and crap your pants. You know, whatever, that's the situation. What they're doing about it. I was over in Djibouti in Camp Lemonnier talking to some of these special operations guys about diarrhea, which was kind of a weird reporting challenge. But I was there with a Navy captain, Mark Riddle, who was testing, doing some clinical trials of a different regimen antibiotic treatment that you just, with one dose, you would be back in the action after less than a day. And that would help a lot. You know, normally in a battlefield, you try to improve sanitation and hygiene, and that's at the bases. Things are very sanitary and very hygienic. There are, you know, Purell stations and hand washing stations as you go into the dining facility. This big dining facility, there's a row of hand washing sinks. And so there's a lot of work done, you know, a lot of work done to keep troops safe on base. But once you're out with the local population, there's not much prevention to be done. So the key is to find drugs that will work more quickly. And that, of course, makes its way back to the civilian traveler. So that's a plus.
You pride yourself on being part of your research. You say that the most challenging thing that you did for this book, Grunt, was going on a submarine. Why is that?
Well, it was, being on a sub wasn't challenging, but getting on the sub was a little challenging because it was a ballistic missile submarine. So it's a submarine that is out. It's got the power source is nuclear, so that it doesn't need to surface for fuel. So it can stay down for months at a time. And that whole idea is just, it's a roving nuclear arsenal, Trident missiles on board. Nobody knows where it is, except, of course, the people who know where it is, the handful of people who know where it is. So getting access was a little difficult, partly logistically, because it's out for months, and they weren't going to want me on board for months, nor did I want to be on board for months. I wanted to be on board for a few days, a week. So in the end, and it took about a year to figure this out and have it happen, I ended up going out with a group of prospective commanding officers who were doing a practical exam on board this submarine, where they'd be, you know, there'd be all simulated emergencies that they would then have to deal with, which made it a really interesting time to be on board the submarine. Yeah, we're going to do a simulated launch of all missiles, which was really surreal. And so that took a long time to figure out. And there's not, at the time, they just started having female officers. They were, the crew were all male. So there was a lot of space for women on board. You know, space is very tight. So that was also a problem.
Yeah, I think you say that the space was so tight that they even have some of the sailors sleeping between nuclear missiles, right? Instead of
in the missile compartment, there are two long rows of missile silos, and there's just about enough space in between to put down a bedpan, not a bedpan as in to pee in, but a mattress, basically. Yeah. A unit to hold in a mattress. So and those were kind of some of the quieter, more private accommodations on board the sub. I mean, if I had to choose, I think I might be sleeping between the missiles rather than in a room with, you know, 10 bugs.
I have to think that the biggest issues that they face on a nuclear sub are psychology and sleep deprivation.
And that's what that chapter is about. When the subs went nuclear, there was a lot more that need to be watched. So the watch schedule was the watch bill, as they call it. These had been set up from years ago, when there was this belief that because there's no sunlight down there in a submarine, you can just make up how long the day is. It doesn't have to be 24 hours. We can do an 18-hour day if that works better with the shifts. In fact, over time, it's become clear that even though there isn't sunlight, the body still wants to be basically on 24-hour cycle. That's the circadian rhythm. And when you mess with the length of the day, not only do you have sleep-deprived submariners because they've got too much to do, but also they're jet lagged. So they were dealing with a kind of man-made jet lag. So what the submarine I was on, the USS Tennessee, the commanding officer was trying out a more circadian rhythm-friendly watch bill so that everybody was, it's complicated to explain sort of exactly what they were doing to achieve that, but they were distributing the chores and the sleep and wake schedules in a way that at least they would be on a normal human biological time frame.
You spend some time with medics in training. Medic training seems like it's almost impossible to fully train for. How do you teach them to prepare for the unknowns in combat?
Well, you can try to simulate combat as accurately as you can, and that is what's done. I was down at a place called Strategic Operations near Camp Pendleton and near Santa Barbara, Southern California. And what they do there is pretty impressive. This is a former action movie studio, so they've got sets, and there are one is like an Afghan village. They've got, you know, a call to prayer recording. They've got recordings of bullets and people screaming. And they're actually firing off pyrotechnics. They've got dust hits to make it look like it really is rifle fire. And then the people, they introduce these training, medics in training, into these scenarios. And they have to render medical care under that kind of stressful environment, chaotic, loud environment. And the people that they're working on, their patients are, in some cases, amputee actors. They're people who've been outfitted with like a sleeve over the stump that's very realistic. They've got a backpack with a little kind of a camelback containing stage blood, so that's being pumped out, so they're bleeding at a realistic rate. And if they don't get the tourniquet in place properly, if they don't do their job right, the patient bleeds out and dies. And these Navy corpsmen who are medics for the Marine Corps, of course they know, obviously, they didn't blow off somebody's leg for this. I mean, rationally, they know that that's not real, but it is when you're in the midst of it, very realistic and pretty stressful for them. So it's kind of believed that it's sort of like a stress inoculation. It's like a milder dose of what they're going to have to deal with in a real combat scenario, and hopefully training them there will kind of prepare them a little better for dealing with what is to come. And the other problem is with fight or flight, it makes you got adrenaline coursing through your system. It makes you fast and strong, but also kind of dumb. Like, you get tunnel vision, you don't make good decisions, your hands are shaking, it's hard to operate, say, a piece of medical equipment that is, requires careful placement of a needle, say, or, you need to have your wits about you, and you tend not to when you're panicked. So it is important to try to train medics a little bit for the realities of rendering medical care under fire.
Did you pick up on any friction between the scientists working in a controlled environment and the troops who are counting on these ideas and inventions to save their lives in real-world combat?
Yeah, there is a sense sometimes that the folks in the labs and the folks in the air-conditioned offices back home who are making rules and saying, this is how much water you need to carry with your unit today to avoid dehydration. This is how, that kind of a one rule fits all. There's a resistance to that among some, in this case, it was a couple of Army Rangers that I spoke to, the sense that a unit knows best what it needs, the unit commander, because every situation is different. And when you try to have a set of precautions and rules that will apply to everyone in all situations, that is resented sometimes. Yeah. You know, it's done with the best of intentions. Like, let's, you know, heat stroke is a real issue here. We need to make sure people are well hydrated. You need to carry a certain amount of water. But if you're also talking about, you know, how much ammo do we need to carry? And we don't want to run out of ammo if we're in a situation where we're under attack. And so their intent is good, but sometimes there's a feeling that they don't know what they're talking about because they're not out here and they're not dealing with what we're dealing with. And fair enough, you know, that I could imagine one might feel that way.
I also have to imagine that the Pentagon is pretty protective of their military research. How hard was it for you to get access? Did you hit a lot of roadblocks?
I expected to hit a lot of roadblocks, and I didn't, unless something was classified. And sometimes things were that I didn't expect to be a problem were classified, and that's it. If it's classified, the answer is no. For example, the camouflage lab at Natick in Massachusetts, where the uniforms and the accessories of war are designed and tested, that lab I couldn't go into. There's no wiggle room there. If it's classified, it's classified. But most of the other things I reported on, there wasn't an effort to keep me out at all. There was a sense that this is good work being done here, and it doesn't get reported on or talked about all that much. And so I was actually welcomed into most of these places. The problems were, it tended to be, you can come here, but we don't really know who signs off on this. It's fine with me, but we've got to find the right person to say yes. Nobody was saying no, but like, whose swim lane is this in? Who's the person who signs off? And that, especially with the ballistic missile submarine, that was a, going up and down the chain of command, going up to the top, all right, we're okay there, and then back down again to who wants to be the commanding officer who has me on his sub. That was another challenge. So sometimes it was a matter of just finding the person who was willing to say, yeah, let's do this, and here's what needs to happen. Because, people are busy and they don't really know if it's within their jurisdiction to allow the science writer to come to Camp Lemonnier and report on diarrhea. Like, whose bailiwick is that?
Yeah. Well, before we go, have you decided on the topic of your next book?
I have not. No, I've pursued a couple of things that turned out to be dead ends, and am trying to figure that out.
Really? What kind of topics turned out to be dead ends?
I was going to report on natural disasters and kind of the human elements. Mm-hmm. And I was able to set up a lot of things in the realm of preventing and aftermath, but the actual on scene, getting there quickly, I mean, this, because it could happen anywhere in the world, and where it happens determines which aid organizations and responders are there. So, of course, you have to set it up with these organizations and responders ahead of time. Otherwise, you're just in a big press pool fighting Anderson Cooper for a seat on the chopper. So I really, it was just impossible. There are also some liability concerns that organizations have. And just too dang hard.
Yeah, logistics must be
logistics,
terrible.
Yeah.
Well, again, the book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. It's available in hardcover, ebook, audiobook, and now in paperback as well. Mary Roach, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks again to Mary Roach for joining me on the podcast. Order Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War on Amazon, or download the audiobook for free with a special promotion just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Keep up with her at maryroach.com and follow her on Twitter at @Mary_Roach. Be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kickass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kickass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.